good music writing can sometimes be harder to come across because there is no true north or south. And I had spent so many years thinking about those problems, how to write about wordless feelings that felt overpowering with no real referent, that when I was faced with writing about grief, I almost felt like I had tools to work with.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Culturally Relevant, a podcast featuring conversations about film, television, art, and culture. I'm David Chen, and today I'm going to be speaking with writer Jason Green. Jason Green is a contributing editor at Pitchfork magazine. His writing has appeared in The New York Times and The Washington Post. In May of 2015, a brick fell from the eighth floor of a New York City apartment building, striking and killing Jason's two-year-old daughter, Greta. It was a tragic story that made headlines in major news outlets. Jason's new book, Once More We Saw Stars, tells the story of Greta's death and how it affected him and his family. It has been named by multiple publications as one of the best books of 2019. Once More We Saw Stars is one of the most vivid and staggering accounts of grief I've ever come across. Green's prose is compelling, and it takes you through the moment-by-moment thoughts, feelings, pain, and determination that he experienced in the aftermath of an unthinkably tragic event. This is a book that changed me after I read it. I felt like I came away with a deeper understanding of the human experience. It's that revelatory. I have so much admiration for this book, and I want people to read it, but I also understand that it is challenging to subject yourself to experiencing someone else's grief. I can't unequivocally recommend this book to everyone because I think it's extremely intense, and you need to be ready to have an experience like that. But I can say this. I have never personally lost a child, but I have lost things in my life that are important to me. And what Jason's book helped me to do was to come to terms with some of that loss, and most importantly, to feel less alone. To understand that there are people out there who have experienced much worse tragedies than me, but they can articulate them and the maddening and paradoxical emotions that they spawn. And that was just an extremely valuable experience. I hope you can appreciate this conversation and that you'll consider checking out the book. Again, it's Once More We Saw Stars. It's a book that I will hold in my heart for a very long time. Of course, you can always find episodes of this podcast at culturallyrelevantshow.com and also find us on Apple Podcasts or follow us on Twitter at CrevShow. That's CrevShow. So all that said, without further ado, here's my conversation with Jason Green. Jason Green, thanks so much for speaking with me today.
Thank you so much for having me.
So Jason, I've been interviewing people for many years, but this interview has felt like one of the highest stakes interviews I've ever done because it's about something that's so close in terms of time and something so tragic. It occurred to me while reading the book that like reliving these events for the purpose of the book must have been really tough, but then needing to go out on press tour for podcasts like this one must also be a challenge. So as we're about to begin talking, do you have any advice for me as an interviewer in terms of how I should approach this interview and maybe what I should or should not talk to you about?
Oh, my. I appreciate that is a very thoughtful question to start with, David, but I would tell you to be fearless as you would be in any good interview. Generally, I think I'm someone who interviews people as well. When someone consents to be interviewed, they are consenting to be asked questions by someone who's deeply curious, and therefore all they really can ask is that the person they're talking to exercise that curiosity intelligently, thoughtfully. I'm sure you're going to do that. I would never dream of telling a person who wants to ask me questions about my book what they can and cannot ask me. I will say that because it is about trauma and tragedy, that sometimes I discover in the midst of a conversation, oh, I don't want to talk about this. But usually you can just say, you know what, I think I'm done talking about this for now, if that's okay. So no prerequisites involved, please.
All right. Thank you for letting me know and appreciate that. That's a great attitude in general. So it's one thing to experience a tragedy. It's another thing to write about it, publish it, put it out for the world to see. Both can be unique experiences. They can also be uniquely intense, uniquely painful. What was it that motivated you to want to write this book in the first place?
I think that I answer that question by talking about how slowly I decided to write the book in the first place, if that makes sense. Because I did not all of a sudden decide after my daughter Greta died that I was going to write a book and that I was going to publish it and that the world would read about our story. I think that I was writing compulsively from a few days after we got home from the hospital to make sense of my reality. And I was filling virtual pages every day and dating them. And what I had was this on-the-ground document of every single thing I was feeling at the worst moment of my life, at this unimaginable tragedy, at this moment at which everything had been completely fractured and which reality had basically switched off for me. I had thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands of words, and they were just kind of pouring out of me, like, you know, not to be purple, but somewhat like something coming out of a wound. It just kind of happened. So I had a lot of words that I think I was needing to put to the experience, and it was happening in real time. Basically, I decided slowly and over a series of months that, one, I was not just writing these words for only myself. And I don't think I went any further in my mind than that. And two, that I was writing a book that I then wanted to publish over the course of 6 months. So basically the moment when I said, okay, I think I realized that what I actually have been doing with all of this is writing a book, is when my wife Stacy told me she was pregnant again after Greta died. And to me, that felt so definitive that I felt like I needed to do something definitive in response for myself. And that's when it all clicked into place for me. And I took friends and family and stuff out to drinks. And I said, I have two pieces of news. And one of them is that Stacy's pregnant again. And the other one's that I'm writing a book. And so from there, it became a process of sorting through what I had already written down. Some of it was, quite frankly, just journal venting, you know, not meant or needed for anyone else. And some of it was a firsthand experience about what it was like. And I started sorting it out into a structure. So very early on, I was thinking about this sort of distance between, you know, there was my experience, which was mine, and then there was what I was going to sculpt from it. And that became the book. I mean, on the one hand, yes, I've written a memoir about the death of my daughter. And all the names and places are, you know, except for the names and places of the family, at least, are the same. It's incredibly close to my life and to the lives of my family. And on the other hand, every single word that's in that book is a word that I placed there and that everyone who is implicated in that book saw beforehand. So there's a sense that we feel like, you know, this is the story that we want. Which isn't to say there's some other story that isn't being told. It just means that by the time this book actually was ready, you know, we were afraid of the possibility of the immensity of the exposure, just like the number of strangers who would suddenly know these things about us. But there was nothing in the book we were afraid of people knowing at all. Mm-hmm. And I use the we, I realize, a lot without really catching myself. I was the writer of this book and I did all of the work, but of the writing. But everyone in my family had so much input into it. I didn't write the memoir like some people do, where they kind of go rogue and, you know, tell this story against the objections of their family. I would write a paragraph about my mother-in-law and I would text it to her from the cafe that I'd written in it that day and said, this is about you. I wanted you to see it, you know, and she would say, that's beautiful. Or actually I wasn't there or something, you know? Mm-hmm.
So let me ask you, you were saying that when your wife told you she's pregnant, that you wanted to do something definitive. And I kind of just want to probe a little bit about that. Like, what do you mean by that? Like that this would be kind of you, like, because of your wife's pregnancy, like that this was something that she was contributing and you wanted to contribute something that kind of did honor to, your late daughter? Or like, what do you mean by definitive there?
I think I meant something that would help me. That would help me define my grief process as I was getting ready to be a father again. What was I doing by writing thousands of words if not trying to sort and sift through my feelings and figure out how the world that I lived in now was different from the world I lived in before? And when Stacy became pregnant again, that whole process, it took on a new urgency. And suddenly, I felt like I had to make something that existed in the world, maybe in a way, to be in the place where Greta wasn't. You know, we had a family, and one of the members was not here and was never going to be here. And maybe in some ways I felt the need to define that space mm-hmm. with something. I wanted to put something there where there once was a void, and that would be the book. And, you know, and Greta's on the cover. It's like, in some ways, I mean, I don't go around thinking this way consciously a lot, but I think on some like deep level, I probably look at that book as a sort of weird talismanic sort of place where she used to be.
Mm-hmm. Like a representation of her that can keep going.
Mm-hmm. And that contains everything that we knew of her and that we knew of how much we loved her and of her place within this family. And I felt like I needed to define that. And that's probably the simplest answer. I needed to define her place within this family. And that's what the book became.
The book is exceptionally brave, in my opinion. And one of the things you do is dive into many of your thought processes. You talk about your anger at the world and at other families for being happy. It's stuff that most of us would probably think if we were experiencing something similar, but we probably wouldn't like to admit to it. And I think it's reassuring to hear, you know, somebody else's experience, to hear like somebody else thinks some of the things that might be perceived as unflattering. I'm curious, like, as you were writing, did it ever occur to you that like, hey, this doesn't make me look good? And like, what was your reaction to that? How did that shape the book itself?
Interesting question. I mean, I think what you're kind of asking me about is like a sort of narrative portrayal decision about how, you know, the protagonist makes themselves sound in a book. You know, I mean, you're asking me about my life, but you're also asking me about sort of how I chose to write about it.
Yeah.
And I mean, in a way, you're asking me sort of like, why did you create an unlikable character or allow a character to be unlikable or unflattering in your book? Especially if that character is you.
Right. I would not describe the character as unlikable at all. I would say that they occasionally, if they are a character, you know, obviously it's you, but like that they are human. You know, they have unlikable qualities or moments to them where they might not act like as nobly as one could possibly be, which like no one would in that situation. You know what I'm saying?
So you just answered the question you asked me. Why would you ever put those moments in the book? Because books are supposed to attest to humanity. Books are supposed to show people as they are. I mean, why does literature even exist if not to sort of give people an entryway into the thoughts and the experiences of somebody else? I wanted to write a book that felt like it was a real one, and you know, anything real went in. you know, that what could be more? And also, in the sense of sort of in asking that question, there's this implicit sort of suggestion that I was risking something because you used the word brave. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting to me to think about that because in terms of writing the book in particular, because in terms of bravery, I had just about the best alibi for being a bitter, horrible asshole that the universe can give you. And I knew that writing the book, and I knew that I did not know that in life. In life, I actually wondered that I worried and wondered if I was becoming, to wit, a bitter, horrible asshole. And that was a struggle. I thought, now I'm somebody who is racked by hateful thoughts and feels angry all the time and can look at something as innocent as a happy family and feel rage. Those were very real feelings. And what you don't always know for yourself, sometimes you can understand when you put it into writing. I knew that the character in the book would be forgiven for those feelings because the character in the book had gone through the worst possible thing, but I wouldn't necessarily have extended that sort of clemency to myself as a person. But I understood, like, writing this down, no one's going to judge me for thinking this. Look what happened to me. It was a funny sort of remove, if that makes sense.
Yeah. At various points in the book, you and your wife do things to try to cope with loss. You attend grief counseling sessions. At one point, you even see a medium. You're in like a session with a medium. And I'm curious, how did the events of the book shape your views on religion and spirituality?
I think they made me more open to any and all experiences for whatever they could give me of Greta. I think that all those experiences just softened and opened me up to possibilities more than they changed my ironclad views. I was not a hardline anything before Greta died. I was not a hardline atheist. I just was somebody who had not grown up within a religion. And I didn't assign it a ton of special importance, either its absence or its presence in my life. It was something that prior to Greta dying, I had never felt a deep spiritual need for. And this is a strange anecdote, but it's one of those moments that washes up back onto your consciousness years later when you haven't thought about this moment. I had a conversation with a girlfriend when from years before I even met Stacy, like another life. And she and I came from like very different backgrounds and families. And I remember her saying to me once, "Hasn't life ever been so bad that you just felt like you needed Jesus?" And I remember looking at her and thinking, "I don't know what you're talking about." No. And I don't say that to say that I rediscovered a religion, but after Greta died and I found myself reaching for spirituality, I remembered her and I remembered that comment. And some small part of me almost wanted to reach out to her to tell me that I thought about it again, because I understood what it meant to need something bigger for the first time in my life, bigger meaning spiritual. And so I didn't need a specific religion or a specific community. I think I looked towards all of these opportunities, you mentioned the medium, as possible portals. Greta or something of Greta might lie behind this door. And what doubt could possibly be powerful enough for me to resist opening it? I've also said in talking about this sort of spiritual journey that my wife and I undergo in the book, that one of the things you do when you become a parent is that you find yourself in unfamiliar situations constantly. You are talking to people that you might not have talked to. Doesn't mean you don't like them, but you are meeting strangers. You are suddenly engaging in whole new arenas. Maybe your kid gets into some activity you've never heard of before, and you find yourself becoming an expert in some completely foreign thing. This is what children do in many ways. And there was a weird and sort of haunted inverse to that feeling that we had when Greta died. She had gone somewhere we didn't know how to get. And we were going to put aside all of our preconceptions to figure out how to get there ourselves.
The book is very beautifully written, and you move effortlessly into metaphor and out of metaphor. And I am just kind of curious, like from a writing technique level, you talked about how all these words just kind of poured out of you. And like when you're writing about things that have just occurred to you, like do you like think in metaphor as well? You know, like even just now you're talking about like a door and a place and, you know, going to that place. And I'm curious, like, is it just how you think and then you're writing it out? Or do you like sit and think about like the best way to illustrate certain concepts to people?
I don't do that. I just think that way. I think that if you spend a long time searching for the metaphor that might connect to some imagined reader to your experience, you're not going to find anything there that will provide you what you're looking for. I sat down and wrote those metaphors for myself. The only way you can really triangulate your experience is through metaphor, I find, emotional experiences anyway. This thing is like this thing, or this thing has become this thing for me. That's what interpretation is to me. You know, you interpret through metaphor. To speak to that in terms of my writing, I think that I had spent a decade plus writing about music. And while I didn't look at that as being any particular training ground, I did find that sometimes when I was writing about my grief, I thought, I feel like I'm writing about music in some ways, because it is this invisible, powerful thing, right? After all, you can't see music, whereas art critics or movie critics can write about things that are happening on a screen or on a wall and you can describe paint or light or, you know, things that are actually sort of physically present. Music is just vibrating air. It happens inside of you. It's evanescent. It disappears. It literally only happens inside your body. Recorded music, any music really. And you have to write about it. You have to sort of write about these invisible experiences that are happening inside of you that are overwhelmingly powerful. I think it's one of the reasons that good music writing can sometimes be harder to come across, because there is no true north or south. And I had spent so many years thinking about those problems, how to write about wordless feelings that felt overpowering with no real referent, that when I was faced with writing about grief, I almost felt like I had tools to work with.
Well, I think the book is so beautiful, and there's so many metaphors in it that will just stick with me, you know, for a really long time. This is not a question. I'm just letting you know what I feel about it, you know? I want to, like, point some of them out to you, but, like, I don't know. I feel it'll almost do a disservice for me to, like, read it back to you, you know what I mean?
I'm always curious, because these things were just – I mean, like I said, I did just write them down for myself. I'm always weirdly curious. What did someone else respond to in this? I mean, in some ways, it's like describing your dreams to somebody. You're like, this is either going to sound really cool to you or totally meaningless, and I don't know which. So, I mean, honestly, whether or not you have them in front of you, I'm always interested to learn, especially with stuff like that, because you write these things trying to sort of make an impact on yourself, right? First, you're your own first reader, and measuring the distance between what feels to you impactful in the moment and then what lands on somebody else, that's the humbling work of writing. And most of the time someone's like, I don't know what that means at all, man.
I read the book on Kindle, and Kindle has this cool feature where you can, like, highlight the book, and then at the end you can, like, export all of your highlights into, like, one file. So I exported all my highlights. It's like, you know, usually I'll make, like, a dozen highlights. With your book, it's like dozens and dozens of highlights, but one of them is on page 13, if you'll permit me to read it back to you, is that okay?
Of course. I'd love that. Be honored.
You write here, quote, "We know Greta is going to die, all of us, although we haven't allowed the thought into our conscious minds yet. None of us is ready for it to maraud through our subconscious, killing and burning everything it sees. But we hear the banging at the gates. We glance around us, realizing this is the last we'll ever see of the world as we've known it. Whatever comes next will raise everything to the ground," end quote. This idea that this, like, knowledge, this suspicion, right, is you compare it to, like, you know, barbarians at the gate storming the castle of your lives and just destroying everything. It's just like it's obviously extremely vivid, but it's also like it makes me think about, like, other times in my life when I felt like this kind of dread, you know, like that you know, when you have something in your life that's that, you know, once you acknowledge its existence, is going to just change your whole paradigm for thinking of the world. It just is put to, it was brought to life so beautifully and brutally in that excerpt. You know, I'm just, it's like there's some passages like that will stay with me for a very long time. So that's why I asked the question.
Wow. Well, thank you, truly. And that sounds a very pat response to something that beautiful. But really, you can't get much more profound or meaningful feedback as a writer to another human being, David. So thank you for telling me that.
Well, thank you for chatting with me. I really appreciate hearing about your process. I have a few more questions for you. One of them is, in the book you write about how being somebody who is grieving has profound social implications, you know, and I think that's fascinating to think about. I think, like, many of the social implications are negative. Like, you talk about how, like, people don't think of you differently, and usually, like, their desire to spend time with you may change because of the things you're going through. And because I think at one point, you know, you talk about, like, how, like, maybe they don't want to be associated with, like, the tragedy that you've been through. But then you also write about how, like, there's one part in the book that really struck me. You're in a room with a bunch of other grieving people, and you tell the story of your daughter, and then you write in the book, quote, "I hear the gasps From the corner of my eye, I see the dog of self-pity trotting up near me and wagging its tail. Even in this room with these people, you're still a rock star of grief, it says, cocking an eyebrow. Even these shattered people can't imagine being you. How about that? End quote. And that was also like really a profound moment, because that even in this moment that there's this kind of weird is pride the right word? You know, like that there's this kind of weird emotion of like that you have this story that like trumps all these other stories. And like this is kind of what I was referring to earlier, is like if I was in that situation, I would probably think that, but I would not want to acknowledge that I had that part of me, you know?
Right.
So like what do you when you're writing that section of the book, like, and I think that's the only section where we do see the dog of self-pity. I don't think that's a recurring character. But like
I mentioned self-pity one other time in that section, I think, where I talk about how Stacy and I try not to succumb to it the way we try to like floss daily. It's like a
right
constant battle to sort of maintain this front against what is seemingly inevitable. That moment, it was purely self-pity. That's why I named it thus. There was no pride in that moment, although it's interesting, and I understand exactly what you mean by that word and why you would reach for it in that instance. But the reason that I called it self-pity was because what I was thinking was, you'll never find anyone who'll help you. You are so alone in the universe. The worst thing in the world has actually happened to you, and you're going to be alone with it forever. And that was my fear, and that was the awfulness of even these shattered people can't imagine being you. I wasn't taking any kind of perverse pride.
Interesting. In that. Yeah, because I was kind of latching towards the latching onto the term rock star, you know, which kind of evokes this.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like that's kind of why.
I think that there was bitterness there too, because we were unfortunately news headlines. And because, you know, Greta's death was reported on in the paper, I probably reached for that because it was trivial. The idea of being a rock star of grief is such a horribly sort of trivial and perverse and sickening idea. And yet I was sickened in many ways. I was struggling with the sense that we were bleeding. We were suffering this most primal wound, and we were doing it on an open stage. There were news trucks crawling up and down the city when we were still at Greta's deathbed, trying to get a picture of us and calling the hospital and posing as family members to try and figure out where we were staying so they could ambush us when we left. The next day, Greta's picture was in the front page of the Daily News, plucked right from Stacy's Facebook wall. And we walked out of the hospital out of a side door so that news trucks wouldn't find us. The senior administrator of the hospital was marching us out. I was holding a clear plastic bag with my daughter's blankie and stuffed dog in it. And on the way out the door, I looked to my right, and in the bin out in front of the bodega was a picture of my daughter from our apartment staring at me, waving to me from the cover of the Daily News, because we hadn't put privacy protections, I suppose, on our Facebook photos, and you could just Google them. So somebody took one and made it the photo. So when you read that line, a rock star of grief, there's a hell of a lot of anger in it. It is not a position of pride, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, it totally does. You were just referring to kind of how this story has spiraled out a little from your family. Like this, it was in the news. It did prompt investigations into like the safety of specific buildings. And I'm curious, like, what has been your reaction to the reaction to both the story and the book? You know, like both in terms of New York City, but also like all the people who have read the book, all your family members who have read the book. Like, it's out in the world now. The story's out in the world now. Like, how have you reacted to what has happened since from external factors, you know?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that the reaction to the book is the reaction to what I wanted the world to know of Greta's life. It's affirmative. It's beautiful feeling to me. It's different than the reaction to her death, which I had no control over, and which was simply happening to me and to us and to her. I mean, it's happening to her, you know, and I had no control over what people thought or knew or said. It was a lot of control to lose in your life at one moment. So my feelings about what the world was giving me then in terms of what people said to me, where the reactions came from, it was very different than the feeling I have now that I put a book out with a picture of my daughter that I took on the cover, and that it's the story of her life and our family. What people are reaching out to me to say now is, I see something of myself in this story, or your story helped me make sense of mine, or your book was very beautiful. Thank you for giving me a glimpse of what this was like. I'm so sorry I had to go through it. People just expressing some mix of profound gratitude, love, respect, and in many cases, vulnerability, sharing with me things about their lives that have happened to them. And that to me is beautiful and exalted, incredible. That makes this book so different than another book could ever be. And that's because Greta is in it, you know, and my love for Greta is in it. So when you asking me about external reactions, the world responding, the sort of responses that I'm getting from the world now are responses I've solicited. The book is the version of the story because our story got told for us while we were living it. And so that was another, when I said earlier to you that I felt I needed to do something definitive, there's an element of that as well. I have to retell this story because it was told for us. And I have nothing but gratitude for people who have read the book and want to tell me something about it. Nothing but gratitude. There's no other feeling. There's no underlying negativity for me to feel. I'm just eternally grateful to people for picking it up, for opening it, for reading it, for reading through the first 40 pages, which is us being by our daughter's bedside at her death and soldiering on, choosing to live through that experience with us, even vicariously, when they don't have to. That means the world to me.
Well, Jason, I have one last question for you, and that is that everyone reacts to grief and tragedy differently. As someone who's gone through it, people have probably said or done helpful and unhelpful things during the course of your grief. And so with the caveat that different people have different answers, I'm curious, like, what are the things you think people should and shouldn't do or say if they have a loved one who's grieving? Because I think people, like, think they know what to do or they would do certain things, but then, like, many times people just end up inflicting more pain or burden with the things they say or do. And so I'm curious, like, if you had to give advice to people who have friends who are grieving, like, what advice would that be?
Honestly, the best thing you can say to somebody in grief is probably some variant, "I'm so sorry this happened," and then just sit down and be there for them. I think that people want to fix situations. I'm no different. And just because I have lost a daughter and been someone grieving does not mean that I have emerged on the other end with a black belt in social niceties, and that whenever someone's grieving or in pain, that I suddenly tune into this place of knowledge and I know what to say. I am the same as everyone else. I'm a human. I'm like, oh God, what am I supposed to say? It's normal. So the first thing I always want to tell people when this question comes up is, your anxiety is normal. It does not make you defective. It does not make you bad. Your anxiety probably wells from a good place. Your deep, real desire to help somebody and not knowing how. And so the thing I always say to tell yourself, or rather I say the thing I always say to ask yourself is, okay, I'm focusing so much on what the wrong thing to say is. What could possibly be the right thing to say? What could I possibly say to this person that I think will somehow make their grieving less painful? The answer is nothing. There's nothing you can say. I mean, there is no human with that wisdom who can impart some sort of wisdom that will lighten the load. I mean, no one's going to say, oh, gee, I never thought of it that way before. Thank you. It is not your job to impart wisdom. it is your job to be there, to speak from your heart, and to be present. And I had people come over who probably said stuff to me in the moment that they thought of later and said, oh gosh, I wish I hadn't said that. And sure, people will stick their foot in their mouth. But what I always say is that in the final analysis, that meant so little to me as a grieving parent, particularly when this person who may or may not have just said something awkward was showing up. They were in my apartment door. They had a dinner that they made me in their hands. That mattered a lot more. And they sat down and talked to me. And whether or not that meant talking about Greta, or maybe I asked them about their work because I needed distraction, and they did that. What you do matters a lot more than what you say.
Well, Jason, I really appreciate you joining me on this podcast today and sharing of yourself with me.
Thank you.
I really appreciate it and appreciate your book as well. The book is Once More We Saw Stars. Jason Green is a writer whose work has appeared in New York Times and Washington Post. He's also a contributing editor at Pitchfork Magazine. Jason, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you so much, David. I really appreciate it.
That's going to bring us to the end of this week's episode of Culturally Relevant. I am so grateful to Jason for appearing on this week's episode. I can't imagine it is easy to talk about a book this personal and this intense, but I'm so grateful for his patience, his graciousness, and for his generosity in taking the time to speak with me. I hope you enjoyed this conversation. If you did, you can find more episodes of this podcast at culturallyrelevantshow.com. Find us on Twitter at CrevShow. That's CrevShow. If you enjoyed this episode, we'd love it if you could leave a review for this podcast on Apple Podcasts or share about us on your social media. This episode was edited and produced by me, David Chen, and it was brought to you by Simplecast. If you are interested in starting your own podcast, check out Simplecast.com. They are a great resource with a lot of awesome features for anyone getting started or for podcast professionals. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next week.